An enemy you can't see.
You're looking for an army to fight. There is no army. Every man, woman, and child in the state of Morelos is Zapata's army.
There's only one thing to do. Wipe them out. All of them.
Excuse me, sir. We can't find anybody to wipe out. We go there, the corn is growing, there's a fire in the hearth, and no one. We burn the house, we destroy the corn. We go back there, a new shelter, and the corn is growing again. The people. They're like a different race. They're not afraid of anything.
Gentlemen, this is not a matter of discussing. It's an idea and it's spreading.
The man!
Cut off the head of this snake and the body will die.
Ideas are harder to kill than snakes. How do you kill an idea?
It's time, General, to stack our arms. In fact, that is the first step. That is my first request of you. Stack your arms and disband your army.
And who will enforce the laws once we have them?
The regular army. The police.
They're the ones we just fought and beat. Give me your watch. Give me your watch. Give it to me. It's a beautiful watch. Expensive. I'll take my rifle. Now you can have your watch back. But without this, never. You draw a strong moral. You ask us to disarm. How could we get our land? Or keep
But it's not that simple. It's a matter of time. And
time! Time is one thing to a lawmaker, but to a farmer there's a time to plant and a time to harvest. And you cannot plant and harvest time.
General Zapata, do you trust me?
Just the way my people trust me. I trust you and they trust me as long as we keep our promises. And not a moment longer.
Where are you going?
I'm going home.
What will you do there?
I will wait, but not for long.
In the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no genocide, for the spirit of my ancestors are with me. My knife and my club, they comfort me. They leadeth me beside still waters. They comfort my soul, and I will dwell in the land of my racial kinsmen forever and ever. Hail Odin. Back with you.
Well, here's Terrible Tommy back in the bunker. Back in the bunker on Moon's Day, Monday. Yeah, it's we still got a lot of snow back here in the Midwest, yeah. And I think you got quite a bit of snow about everywhere. In fact, it was snowing down in Dixie down there, a lot down there in Atlanta, and that nigga mayor got his titna ringer down there. He sure did. It's February the 3rd. Wow, already. February the 3rd, 2014, on Moon's Day. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show and other projects that we're working on. And we'll appreciate that very much. Quite a few of you already got your donations in for February. That's good. That's good. We've got some that contributors have sent in yet, and I sent out some money Saturday, I believe it was, to inmates, and I got some more money to send out, and I'll have to figure out who I'm going to send that to today, too. So we're keeping those boys in chewing gum and pipe tobacco. Chewing tobacco. Well, yesterday I got a call from someone I hadn't heard for a long time, at least my phone call. It happened to be a lady that I've known, you know, loosely for about, ever since Bob Miles was having meetings at his farm up there in Michigan back in the 80s. But she's still just a right-winger, and she'll never change. She sends me about 5 pounds of crap about once every couple of months with all these magazines and all these right-wing stuff that I really don't need. But anyhow, I'm on the phone with her, and we're talking about a few people we've known years in the past, but she's still stuck in a mind warp of the right wing. And she doesn't use a computer, even though she's capable of using a computer. And I told her, I said, you know, you're way behind on the news. I mean, you know, by the time you get the news, it's weeks old. And just calling around on a telephone, that's not the greatest habit anyhow. But I got done talking to her, and I was just thinking, this is not directly connected, but it is sort of connected, that the right wing, I've always known it, but I know it now a lot better since I can stand back and look at it a little more critically. They recruit a lot of mental defectives. Now, every movement in the world recruits mental defectives because they deal in body count. The whole Jewish type attitude is numbers, not really quality. They'll have somebody, maybe quality at the leadership, allegedly, to herd these people around, but they deal always in numbers. And I remember back when I ran the Klan in California KKK, at the end it got so bad that I put the Klan to bed in California because I was spending more time weeding out these mental cases trying to get in. And that is something that is very difficult to do. I was spending two-thirds of my time weeding out mental problems that have got into the Klan and quite a bit of time putting out brush fires that they caused. I was thinking how much better it is with Lone Wolf, because Lone Wolf is not beholden to anybody to be their buddy or socialize with them or anything else. You're your own, and if there's someone you want to socialize with, that's fine. But it's not mandatory. Well, I don't know about you, but I've always been pretty much a loner, except for family and like that. I've never been one that has to be around people all the time. I never had to have a whole bunch of buddies. Never had to hang out at football games and basketball games and all that kind of stuff. And right now, we're in at least pre-revolutionary days in North America. And it gets downright dangerous to be too gregarious, too into socializing. Because that's usually the foot in the door of the federal agents, that groups will have get-togethers and socialize and so forth. These people get infiltrate and they find out everything about your family and where you work and the names of your kids and where they go to school and virtually about everything about you, so NSA doesn't have to do anything there. And that's where, I remember back in the Klan, that's where almost every time the entry point of an agent was through socialization. And so when people talk about Lone Wolf and say, oh, Lone Wolf, they never do anything. Well, the reason, of course, they think they don't do anything is because they don't know what they're doing. And there may be people out there, Lone Wolves, that don't do a damn thing. I mean, they know they're not doing anything, so that's not my problem. But the ones who are doing something, at least they don't have somebody shouting to the rooftop, hey, I was over at this picnic of the KKK, and guess what Harry told me? Guess what Fred told me? They're planning, or what they think they're going to do, or what he's doing, or how many guns he's got. And, hey, did you bring your guns? Are they in the truck? Can I look them over? So you get what I mean. But this mental problem that's with a large number of people that go into any activist organization, don't make any difference whether it's racial or left-wing, right-wing, or what, organizations attract some good people, that's for sure, but a lot of mentally defective people. Or let's put it this way, just not up to par. Now, if you think I'm kidding, go to the chat boards. Go to Stormfront or any chat board and spend a little time reading this dribble that's on these chat boards. That's too bad, because there's a lot of people that have some very intelligent things to say on chat boards, but they're outnumbered 10 to 1 by dummies and mental defects. And there's no way, since a chat board is this democratic idea, democratic thing, there's no way you can police it close enough. You could try to police it, but there's always new ones coming on. They call them trolls. Well, sometimes a troll might be smarter than the rest of the people on the board, but in most cases, a troll just causing problems and or wanting to talk about something that has nothing to do with what the chat board is really about. But if you want to get an an idea of the IQ of racialists in the right wing, you'll go to the big chat boards and look them over. You'll say, "You better stay away from there. You better stay away from there." Now, what's funny about it, and it's not really funny, but our enemies, and even the enemies of lone wolves, will call us all kinds of names. Now, once when I go on the internet and comment to some these news stories where everybody's able to come in and comment, it doesn't seem to make any difference how true or how backed up with evidence that you put on there. They'll come back and start screaming at you and calling you all kinds of names. And these are from the supposedly nice people that are mad at you because you want to separate. And they come back just calling you all kinds of names. That's interesting. Started something today that I probably should have done a long time ago, or maybe I shouldn't do it at all. I have quite a list of people other than private club members who email me, and they automatically get put in a list on the computer, and to where I've got, you know, several hundred of them. And so I started cleaning out those lists of the ones, the emails that were no good, and sending out a message like I send out a sample radio show. If you happen to get something along these lines, it's a duplication of something I'm sending you on your radio show program, well, just forget it or let me know, and I'll eliminate you from that list. In fact, I do, because I want to keep... Of course, I send all this stuff out BCC. Don't ever send this stuff out CC. There's a lot of people out there still sending out racially sensitive material without BCCing it. But anyhow, we'll see if we reach a few more people out there that may want to be lone wolves and may want to get the radio show and so forth. So that's one program we're starting up again. A fellow wrote a book about the Kennedys, and he was pretty close to the Kennedys. In fact, was in and out of the White House. And it's amazing how many people think Kennedy was such a nice guy. But in reality, he was pretty much a pervert, John F. Kennedy, to the point where he was an incessant womanizer. That doesn't necessarily mean he's a bad leader, but I've had in my travels, I've tended to find that people were a little bit more moral, tended to be a little bit better leaders too. Not always. But anyhow, I've got a couple of audio clips here on Kennedy I'm going to play for you. And remember all you people that cussed Johnson for getting the Civil Rights Bill through. It was John F. Kennedy who created and first put that civil wrongs bill into the Senate before he was killed. So, all you people that may want to say, "Oh, poor Kennedy," and "Damn Johnson," remember that. Now, I've told you before that Kennedy was on methamphetamines and is a cocktail of chemicals that Dr., what was his name? Dr. Happiness or whatever this Jew from New York was giving him, along with half of Hollywood. That may answer why he made some bizarre actions. But first, let me put on a little clip here about the anthrax and the Iraq War and so forth. If you watch the film W about George Bush by Oliver Stone, which I just did yesterday, it brings that out pretty well, that Colin Powell was the key pivot man in the whole lie network. Once they got him on board, he went all the way. And it's interesting, here's another black guy that's causing the death of thousands of white Americans, plus hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, on a lie. It was all a lie. And they used the anthrax thing to hook it to Saddam Hussein, and then on and on, and the story just got bigger and bigger. And the Bush crime family's noses got longer and longer.
But the propaganda was used eventually, and when I say eventually, I think late October, they actually started to pivot towards Iraq by linking the anthrax letters to Saddam Hussein's supposed biological weapons program. And if it wasn't for that false connection between the two, Colin Powell wouldn't have been able to get up in front of the UN and hold up that vial of anthrax and say, you know, basically the whole WMD's myth of Saddam Hussein is based on the false connection between Saddam Hussein and the anthrax mailings. And reporters like Brian Ross and Richard Cohen of the Washington Post spread this propaganda to the American public, and the damage had already been done at that point.
And they admitted that also. In your documentary, it clearly shows these people saying that the only reason that they supported the Iraq War was because they thought that the anthrax came from Saddam. I mean, this is a very common narrative that's been largely forgotten. You also mentioned that the Bush administration was on Cipro, the antidote for anthrax, 7 days before the first letter was sent. But, Robbie, 9/11 was a very scary climate. Couldn't it be possible that the administration was preparing for the absolute worst and really just everything at that point?
That's something I hear a lot from people, and unfortunately, almost any angle you try to look at it, it doesn't hold water, because even if they got some kind of intelligence warning suggesting that someone, you know, some Muslim extremist or somebody was going to send a biological weapon to the U.S. mail, ultimately that doesn't make sense, because it was found to have originated from a U.S. bioweapons facility. So how could they have gotten an intelligence warning that the anthrax was coming from within their own government being sent out? And then on top of that, you have to also think that these are, you know, older men. You don't just take a heavy-duty antibiotic like Cipro willy-nilly because you think there might be a terrorist attack coming.
First, they accused a man named Stephen Hatfield and deemed him guilty in the court of public opinion with no evidence whatsoever. Ended up paying him a multi-million dollar settlement. The subsequent suspect, Bruce Ivins, ended up committing suicide, allegedly. Let's take a look at the press conference once the government deemed the case to be closed.
This is obviously, at this point, a circumstantial case. You feel a strong circumstantial case. What direct evidence do you have?
Well, first, I'm going to refer back to the documents, because that's the purpose of our press conference today, to provide you the documents and the information pertaining to the documents.
And even if you want to be as generous as possible in your interpretation, you would say that it's been filled from start to finish with pure ineptitude.
As Greenwald says, it's been filled with pure ineptitude. Best case scenario, Robbie, why do you think that we should have a reason to suspect Ivins as not the anthrax suspect?
Well, I mean, tying this back to Glenn Greenwald, I just first wanted to say that this, you know, he's been doing hard-hitting reporting long before the Snowden revelations, and he sort of pointed out that Bruce Ivins was basically convicted in the court of public opinion with no criminal charges ever brought to him based on a series of emails that he sent privately to his friends and colleagues about how he was depressed. Because ultimately, even the DNA evidence that the FBI says they have linking Ivins to the attacks is invalid. The National Academy of Sciences basically went over all the evidence that the FBI had, and they concluded that the flask that the FBI said Ivins had in his home could not be matched to the anthrax sent in the letters. But then when you look at this through the new light of the NSA revelations that have happened over the past year, Stephen Hatfield pretty much dodged a bullet by basically being targeted as a scapegoat before this NSA spying grid was so fully integrated. Bruce Ivins did not have the same luck, because obviously they found someone who, you know, maybe had depression or other, you know, forms of mental illness, and they put so much pressure on him by basically retroactively going back and demonizing his character through all of these private email correspondences that he had.
As you mentioned in your documentary, trying to get his hospitalized daughter to turn against him, bribing his family, surveilling him 24/7, these are all things that people should check out in American Anthrax. Robbie Martin, my brother, co-host, Media Roots Radio, journalist, thank you so much for your time coming on.
Thank you, Abby.
Well, I assume you remember when that anthrax was being mailed all over the place, politicians and so forth. Incidentally, the two that received anthrax first were the two senators and congressmen, and one was a congressman, one was a senator, both senators that were fighting this so-called Patriot Act legislation. It's interesting. They were first to receive anthrax in the mail.
But Dave Powers, she did it. And she said Kennedy watched. He later apologized to them. But, you know, what word can you apply to it? Perverse?
Robert Dallek, his book, Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. This is Q&A on C-SPAN Radio.
Here's Arthur Schlesinger, who wrote the book A Thousand Days, I believe, and right after the presidency, he was his historian. And here's what he said he knew about the dalliances of JFK.
I mean, the current theory seems to be that everyone in Washington knew about the parade of bimbos through the White House, and that they covered up because they liked Kennedy or because the rules deflected that kind of inquiry. You read Ben Bradley's, but Ben Bradley was Jack Kennedy's closest friend in the press. As head of the Newsweek Bureau, he was at the nerve center of news gathering there. Ben Bradley writes that he did not know about these things. I certainly was not aware of any kind of waywardness which would interfere with the conduct of public business. Do you believe that?
Well, the journalists I talked to, including Bob Novak, said they suspected. They had clues. They thought there were lots of women coming and going from the White House. And in fact, in my first biography, a journalist told me the story that when Kennedy was on the campaign trail in 1960, he was in Northern California. There were a bunch of pom-pom girls from the local college. Kennedy pointed to one of them. His aide went up to this young woman and said to the senator, "Would like to see you in his hotel room." She went up there. And the story the journalist told me, how he knows this exactly, I don't know, is that maybe this young woman told him. But the journalist told me that Kennedy said to this young woman, he looked at his watch and said, "Well, we have 15 minutes. Now, what happened after that, the journalist didn't say. But the point is, sure, they knew, they suspected. And
is the important point then, as you said earlier, that whether it's this president or any president, and whether we knew or didn't know, is whether or not it had an impact on the presidency? Is that the only thing we have to worry about?
Well, I think that certainly is a central proposition. You know, this certainly is between him and his wife as to what their relationship is like, and whether the president is a philanderer or not. But, you know, in this day and age, it seems to me that it would be madness for a president to try and do this, because it's a different world from what it was in the 1960s. So it would be brought forward, it would be all over the the press, all of the television, and would probably destroy the man's presidency, you see. So, but it was a different time in the 1960s. I'm not justifying it. I mean, I think that it was terribly excessive as to what he did with this young woman. On the other hand, I'm also someone who, I'm not a Puritan, and I'm not saying that, my God, he should have just been loyal to Jackie. I mean, that was between them. Now, she knew about this. She knew he was a philanderer. And there was the anecdote that they were up in Canada, and they were in the receiving line, and there was a military aide standing next to a White House military aide. And she said to him in French, who, this man understood French, it's not enough I come to Canada and stand in line, and one of these bimbos was in line to shake her hand. And she was furious at this situation. And who can blame her? See,
Dean Rusk was Secretary of State, and you had this quote. I just wanted you to give some background on this. Rusk had been a cautious but steady presence throughout the discussion. He described his function as trying to, quote, keep the group from moving too far or too fast. Bobby Kennedy privately described him as, quote, playing the role of the dumb dodo for this reason.
Yeah.
Did he think he was a dumb dodo?
Well, he didn't really think he was a dumb dodo, but he saw Rusk that his personality was such that he was very deferential to the president on making a foreign policy. But I think there's a mixed assessment here in the sense that this is what Kennedy wanted. He didn't want a Secretary of State who was going to vie with him and compete with him on the making of foreign policy. The Kennedy administration was a foreign policy administration. Kennedy was not that interested initially in domestic affairs. He was dragged, so to speak, kicking and screaming into dealing with civil rights. And when he dealt with it, I think it was quite courageous of him to put that civil rights bill before the Congress in 1963, because it could have jeopardized his reelection, since he knew he was going to be alienating southern states, southern voters. And they had put him across in 1960. He didn't know he was going to run against Goldwater. He thought he might well be running against him, but he didn't know for sure. And so it was courageous of him to do that. He felt time had come. As I said, he grew, he evolved in that office. But he was very much a foreign policy president, and I don't think he wanted a Secretary of State who was going to be aggressive about challenging what he wanted to do in the context of foreign affairs. What Kennedy complained about was that Rusk didn't have ideas. Some of the things I've already found, for example, about his presidency is that he was trying to use the FBI to get certain journalists and work against Paul Newman, the movie actor, who was advocating Johnson's impeachment in 1967 over Vietnam. And Johnson is trying to get the FBI to go after Paul Newman to see what they can find to use against him. So,
well, I've got it on tape. I've got it on the recording here somewhere, but anyhow, it talks about this 19-year-old aide that worked in the White House that Kennedy was using as his personal punching bag, so to speak. And he called in, called her in, and she had oral sex with him, and then she, Kennedy handed her over to the another fellow, I don't recognize his name, and she did it to him, and then he wanted her to do it to Bob, to Teddy Kennedy, who was in the room at the same time, but she refused, or Teddy refused, or something. And so this is a little bit of a glimpse of St. John Kennedy that people keep talking about. Just remember, all your problems with, most of your problems with blacks today came about from Kennedy putting that bill into the Congress, the Civil Rights Bill, that it ended up that Lyndon Johnson carried it out after he was shot. Well, do you remember Maximilian Schell, the actor? He was actually born in Austria, but they loved to play him as a Nazi war criminal. I think he was in Judgment at Nuremberg and several other playing a horrible, terrible Nazi. He made a lot of money for himself and the Jews doing those kinds of movies. Oh, I forgot. The important thing was he's dead at 83. Goodbye, Maximilian. Maybe you'll be a Nazi in hell, man. Well, they're putting out another book on Woody Allen and how he was having sex with his adopted daughter. Used to drag her up into a cubby hole in the attic, I guess, and have sex with his 10 or 12-year-old adopted daughter. Plus, that went on evidently for years. It wasn't just one time. Yeah, I think Jews sometimes do bad things, right? Okay. Well, I would like to recommend a film I was able to see yesterday on my day off, and that was Nebraska with Bruce Dern. I've always liked Bruce Dern as an actor. And this movie is about, really, the white heartland, white America, the aging white America, and their problems and their wishes and their desires and so forth. It's probably going to mostly appeal to people over 50 years old, but I'm telling you, it's very well done, and it's done in black and white. I think a very good storyline with good lines and so forth is always better in black and white. That's my opinion. And I agree with Orson Welles on that. Some of his great stuff was in black and white. There was not one Negro in the whole movie. There were two Mexicans that were on briefly, but otherwise it's all white senior citizens, better known as old farts. Well, I think I told you earlier about tomato sauce Kerry threatening Netanyahu, nitwit, with boycotts. The U.S. hit back at Netanyahu on Sunday after the Israeli prime minister warned that calls for boycotts of Israel to pressure it over settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are immoral and just unjustified and will not achieve their goal. In a public spat that reflected tensions over slow-moving Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, the State Department rebuked Netanyahu for apparently misrepresenting the words of the U.S. Secretary of State. Tomato sauce Kerry, another senior right-wing minister, also accused Kerry of serving as a mouthpiece for anti-Jew views. Speaking on the record at the start of the weekly cabinet meeting, the Israeli prime minister said that the growing animosity towards Israel will not be taken. We've got 250 A-bombs over here. Watch it, Kerry. You know, people tend to be experts the farther they get from home on their stories. You notice that? We've got a lot of new upstart radio shows that spend all their time talking about the intricacies of what's going on in Syria and all over the Middle East. And some of them speak with such authority that you say, wow, man, that's a very smart person. But if you'll notice, they don't talk much about what's going on inside the United States and directly to the white race and white working class. They spend almost, and some spend all of their time commenting on all these little things in the Middle East and some in Europe, but mostly in the Middle East and like that. So let's get back on the track, boys, and talk about the race. We're in trouble, man. Well, there goes the environment again. Canadian smelter leaks sodium hydroxide solution. Up to 6,600 gallons of sodium hydroxide solution spilled from a Canadian smelter into a sewage line, eventually reaching the Columbia River. Officials say, well, that's going to be great for salmon. Between 3,170 and 6,600 gallons of the chemical solution spilled from the Teck Resources smelter near Trail, British Columbia, Tuesday, flowing into a sewer line leading to the regional sewage plant that discharges into the Columbia River, which travels into the United States on its way to the Pacific Ocean. Thank you, Canada. They're not only giving us goddamn tar sands, filthy ass oil that's only going to be cracked down there in Texas and sent to China anyhow, trying to sell us a bill of goods that's going to provide more jobs and all that bullshit, but now you're sending sodium hydroxide down at us. Some friendly country, Soviet Kanukistan, that's what you are. Well, the headlines are, despite safety emphasis, school shootings continue. Well, there's been no real reduction in the number of U.S. school shootings despite increased security put in place after the rampage at Connecticut Sandy Hook Elementary School in December 2012. In Pennsylvania and New Mexico, Colorado and Tennessee, and elsewhere, gunfire has echoed through school hallways and killed students or their teachers in some cases. Lockdown is now part of the school vocabulary. An Associated Press analysis finds that there has been at least 11 school shootings this academic year alone, in addition to other cases of gun violence in school parking lots and elsewhere on campus when classes were not in session. Well, let's get to the bottom of this thing. I'm going to separate the racial situation. I'm just going to talk about white kids, mostly, because I remember when I was in school, I didn't like school. I didn't like the regimentation of school. Other kids are studying geometry, and I had a science fiction book hidden in my book, behind my book. And I used to skip school a lot, and I went out and worked. I was involved in electronics work when I was 12, 13 years old. And school bored me to death. And that's a lot of the problem with these kids. They're bored to death. They're not challenged, and they're forced into the equality myth and equalized. Some of the kids that react the most are the most creative kids. Yeah, the most creative kids are popping their corks because they start in grade school. All the new rules, you can't do this, you can't do that. And there is no winner. We're all winners. Nobody's better than anybody else or anything like that. No dodgeball, kickball, anything like that. And they've had studies now. They have studies that show that this causes kids to be screwed up in class. They don't expend their energy enough on the playground, and they come in and they're all hyped up, and they've got all this testosterone and no place to go. So not only do kids end up not liking school, they end up hating school. And the schools now, if you'll notice, a lot of the schools that they've put up in the last, say, 20 years, they look like reformatories. The schools look like prisons. And that's what they are. They're just holding areas to keep all these young people off the street. Try to go to a parent-teachers meeting and talk about this and say what I'm saying now at a parent-teachers meeting. They'll run you out and probably have you arrested. But it's not going to get any better, and to blame it on guns is ridiculous. Obviously, guns do a lot of damage, but people who are frustrated and hate their situation can just as easily use knives and things like that. Every time they want to blame it on guns, no, blame it on the educational system itself. Young people are pissed off, and they try to tell them you're all equal. And you're all going to be achievers, and you'll all be Rembrandts, or you'll all be space cadets, and all this kind of stuff. So the kids are all screwed up. So So they say, oh, we'll solve that. Open your mouth. Take this Ritalin. We'll put Ritalin in you. Well, that's not the problem. And also, there's so much, they feed them so much sugar. Kids eat so much sugar, and sugar is actually like a poison. Yes, it is. You should read that book, order yourself a paperback called Sugar Blues if you want to know the damage sugar does and how we subsidize the hell out of sugar. Guys making fortunes off poisoning their people. So the kid starts off in the morning eating a whole bunch of stuff filled with sugar. Then he goes to school, and he doesn't get it worked out at recess because most of the things that are fun, the school administrators say, oh, that's dangerous and bad. You might hurt yourself. And so the kid goes inside and studies a whole lot of stuff he'll never use and don't care about. And the real creative kids are not encouraged. They want to sit you right down there with half the class of a bunch of Negro anthropoids that have no interest whatsoever in bettering themselves, most of them. So what do you expect? Kids come uncorked. Adults come uncorked. People get pissed off and go on a job and shoot people. It's all part of this modern society, this modern Judaism that's been inflicted on us by these psychiatrists and psychologists and big pharma and all that. But they're not going to solve it because they won't admit that's the problem. They won't admit the problem, so how can you solve it? So we just have to sit back and watch it happen. Maybe if there's a kid we can salvage out of the deal, especially salvage your own kid, but if you can help another kid, try to do it. But tell them if they're feeling all this exasperation and tension and all that, you're not nuts, kids. The system is driving you nuts. You know? Remember James Dean's movies? That's the situation. Even in the 50s, we were into that kind of thinking a lot. We were rebelling all over the place. Even in the 50s, we didn't have drugs. And, the most we had was beer and cigarettes. But it was already starting in the 50s. And now it's really started to reach its peak. Think about it. If your kid is in one of these concentration camps they call school, and he's unhappy and he's not achieving anything, get him out of there. Get him out of there. Neither homeschool or, you know, this idea you got to have all these diplomas and stuff to get anywhere. Well, to a degree that's true, but somebody who's really creative and some of the richest people in this country never went to high school. I know my stepfather, who was quite a bit older, but almost like my grandfather, really. But still, he quit school in the eighth grade. But he had made lots of money in his day, and he was a very proficient farmer and livestock dealer and all that kind of stuff. He didn't go to college or anything like that. If you had a kid that would start studying plumbing, say he gets to be about 12, 13 years old, and get him into some kind of studying plumbing or electrician or auto electronics and things like that, he can be out of there making all kinds of money. He'd be wasting his time in school, in regular school. We need trade schools. We need mechanical schools, we need agricultural schools. That's what we need. And we need to get this goddamn Jew equality myth off our back. And, of course, the non-whites who tend to be non-achievers. Not all. Of course, that's not true of all of them. I never did say that. But anyhow, You know what I'm talking about. So if you, next time you see them, somebody shooting up a school, think a little deeper than the goddamn gun. You know, I think my theory is the people who push all the time for female equality actually hate women. They have a subconscious hatred of women because now they want to shove them into combat jobs. And there's, you know, a lot of those female leaders are screaming for this and that. And so now the people that actually have a probably some kind of an innate hatred of women say, oh, okay, that's a good idea. We'll help you do that. So we're going to shove you on the front lines out there where it's going to be really something else, because if a white man has normal feelings in the military on the front lines, it's going to cause a problem when he sees a woman in trouble. For many reasons, and also all the reasons of all the sex that's been going on and the rapes going on in the military. So when these people say they want to help women, like they before they wanted to give them equal, get them into the job corps, but yet when they got them into jobs, they got paid not near as much as a man. You see, that was all a scam by the corporations. They didn't really want equality of the women. They just wanted to use that as an excuse to get them into the workforce and pay them less money and fire their husbands. Well, another good actor, who I don't believe was Jewish, he might have been Jewish, has bit the dust due to the drug trade and the heroin availability that our troops are helping to harvest over in Afghanistan and ship over here and all through Europe. Thank you, U.S. military. Philip Seymour Hoffman was found dead in New York. He's only 46. Found him with a needle sticking in his arm. Cops said Hoffman died in his apartment in the West Village neighborhood of Manhattan. No cause of death has been determined, but officials suspect the actor may have overdosed on drugs. Duh. He had a hypodermic needle sticking out of his arm. He was found in his bathroom around 11:15 a.m. by a screenwriter who called 911. Well, you see how that works? It's too bad he was a good actor. Actually, a very good actor. I forget some of the movies he played in. I think one was Capote, but there were several films. The movie industry destroys so many people. It's unbelievable how many people it destroys. And yet, you know, it's the Jew Empire, and they do it and they get away with it, and they don't care. There's always scads of new young people out there waiting to get into the movie business. But most movie stars, movie people don't win. They usually end up in a bad situation in the end, either in poverty or dead on drugs or alcohol. Seems like the Republicans are in on every issue I'm opposed to anymore. I mean, 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't too bad. In fact, many of their views were my views that long ago. Keystone XL Pipeline unites environmentalists and landowners, I'd rather say conservationists, in a pipe, the pipeline battle. I just put up a sign out front of my place on in my lighted sign says, no to the Keystone XL Pipeline. Of course, I don't think there'll be one in 50 cars that go by that will even know what it means. That's our problem today. It's not the information. It's not available. But you're trying to give it to people that are, for the most part, too stupid to even know what it's all about. I forget, I said something the other day to somebody that everybody in the world should know about, and they looked at me like I was from Mars. They didn't know what I was talking about. I'm not talking about complicated things. I'm talking about relatively simple things. With yet another obstacle removed from the Keystone XL pipeline, it's going to bring black sludge down here from Canada. They've already had pipe breaks up there in Canada, and rail cars blow up. And anyhow, opponents of the project are pressing forward with a lawsuit, public protests, and an effort to inject the issue into the November midterm elections. Supporters and opponents of the transnational pipeline were both quick to claim victories regarding the U.S. State Department's report released Friday, which raised no major objections to the project. Now that's the EPA are going. They're going along with all this stuff. Can you believe it? Can you believe it? Which raises no major objections to the project. The oil industry, some union groups, and congressional Republicans called on the Obama administration to move forward with the project. Well, why is the unions involved? This damn thing's only going to employ about 2,000 to 4,000 people throughout all across the country. Working on that pipeline coming down through the center part of the country, and it's not, and that's only going to be temporary. It's not going to employ all these thousands and thousands of people. The oil industry, some union groups, and well, no, I've already read that. But anyhow, you know, that thing runs within 10 miles of one of the greatest water aquifers in North America, and with us moving into a time of lack of water, California's run out of water, Las Vegas, Nevada's running out of water, they're running out of water in the Southwest, and here they're going to run this filthy pipeline right next to one of our greatest, largest freshwater aquifers in North America. I'm telling you, and the Republicans are really behind it. I'm telling you, these people are becoming, they're not only war criminals, but they're environmental terrorists. But it's, and he's going to do it. You know, we can gripe and bitch all we want, write all the letters we want. They're going to do it. They're going to do it. The goddamn nigger up there working for the corporations is going to do it. He's nothing but a pawn, just like the Republicans. They're all nothing but pawns. Who's this going to benefit? It's going to benefit China. They talk about we need more energy. Well, you're not getting energy. That's going right down the pipeline, and then it's going to be put on the ships and go overseas. That's not going to benefit all you Mexican and nigger drivers out there that grinding out drivers like mad kids. A few years, they're driving a car. You realize how little energy we would have to have if most of that energy wasn't being dribbled away by non-whites who are in the country today? Like I've said before, if you didn't have the blacks here, you didn't have the Mexicans here, you didn't have the Asians here, and you had an all-white populated country, you need about one quarter of their energy that we're using now. So why aren't people understanding that instead of crying about global warming? Because global warming can be directly connected to population. And China's going to prove that big time, because now that it's industrializing all over the place, the environment's going to hell in a handbag in China, if it ever was very good. And then you want to talk, if there's global warming, you're really going to see global warming if factories are all over, more and more factories are all over China, because they're not going to use conservation methods and environmental methods at all. That's why they moved there. That's why these damn capitalist criminals moved to China to get around all this environmental control. Hell with it. We'll pollute China. That won't affect the global warming, will it? Well, here's a stupid white man story. Utah men rocked by felony charges for tipping over a 200 million year old goblin sandstone formation. Two former Utah Boy Scout troop leaders each face a third-degree felony criminal mischief charge after they filmed themselves in October gleefully pushing over a 200-million-year-old goblin sandstone formation in a state park. They won't do as much jail time as it took to make the majestic formation. The charges carry a maximum of 5 years and $5,000 fine. But David Hall, 42, and Glenn Taylor, 45, clearly have been knocked down a notch for their stupid stunt. Well, they should be knocked down more than that. When you destroy natural formations like that, that are a treasure to the country, to give them a $5,000 fine and put them on probation for 5 years is not enough. It's not enough. But it does show you a sort of a cross-section of what the white North American is getting to be like. The N-word ball, Super Bowl mentality type guys, and give me a case of beer and let me go out and have fun types. This is what our white male population has become. Well, we've got another Stand Your Ground case coming up in Florida. Florida prosecutor in the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case must expect to win a new Stand Your Ground trial since she'll try it herself, a lawyer said. Angela Corey, state attorney who charged Zimmerman with second-degree murder in the Martin's shooting death, but then assigned others to lead the prosecution, may be seeking to rehabilitate her image after the Zimmerman acquittal because she believes this time the prosecution will win. Jacksonville criminal defense lawyer Janet Johnson, a legal commentator, during the Zimmerman trial told the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville. The case, whose jury selection was started Monday, involves Michael Dunn, 47, and white man, charged with first-degree murder in the November 23, 2012 shooting death of Jordan Davis, who was 17 and black after an argument over his loud thug music. Oh, well. There was nothing else involved, of course, you know, just a white guy picking on a black kid again. So here comes all the black reverends down there to Jacksonville. Here we go again. Here we go again. Now, the white guy faces life without parole in this case, if he's convicted. The white guy and his fiancée were heading home from his son's wedding when they stopped at a Jacksonville convenience store next to a sport utility vehicle. Davis was sitting in with three friends. The white guy complained to the teenagers about their music and told them to turn it down, police said. You've heard that kind of stuff before, playing that damn loud nigger music, so loud you can't think. One of the friends turned it down, but then Davis turned it back up. That was a so-called victim. An argument began, and Davis cursed Dunn, police said. Quote, you can't talk to me like that, a person walked out of the convenience store said he heard Dunn say. Probably a white person, ready and willing to testify against another white person when he could have said, I didn't hear anything. Dunn said he saw a gun in the SUV and felt threatened. Davis yelled, you're dead, expletive. This expletive is going down now. Dunn told the WJXX-TV Jacksonville TV in an October 2013 letter, I was convinced that the loss of my life was imminent. Dunn's letter continued, I had no choice but to defend myself. He fired multiple shots at the Durango, killing Davis, his arrest report says. The white guy had a concealed weapon permit and had a 9mm handgun in his glove compartment. The teens quickly fled away to the adjacent parking lot and then returned about 90 seconds later, witnesses told police. Dunn and his fiancée fled and drove home to Satellite Beach, Florida, near the Kennedy Space Center. Police arrested him the next day using his license plate number to track him down. The white guy faces three additional counts of attempted murder of friends, Leland Brunson, Tommy Storrs, and Tevin Thompson, who were in the Durango with Davis when Dunn opened fire on them. The surviving teens said they never had a gun. Of course, they had plenty of time to get rid of it. The police never found one in the Durango or elsewhere, yeah. We know how that works, don't we? Dunn attorney Corey Strola said he had planned to argue the friends hid a gun when they briefly left the convenience store. He told the Times Union witnesses reporting seeing two men jump out of the SUV after it drove into an adjacent parking lot and appeared to be trying to hide something. Quote, "We know that vehicle drove away and there are about a dozen dumpsters in that area," Strola told the newspaper in an email. Well, you can see how this is going to go. They're going to crucify this white guy, even if he escapes going to prison for the rest of his life. They'll ruin his wife and his family's family life and the whole bit. Well, I said for Moon's Day, all this good news. I hope you can handle it all. 14-5 and shut up. And be extremely careful in these kind of situations like this guy got into, because they're trying to use the blacks to stampede you. And I don't know in these situations, what if I'd have been there, what I would have done. But I think under the circumstances, I would have driven away. I know I wouldn't want to. I'd like to do something about it, but perhaps it'd be best in a situation like that to just live to fight another day, but don't fight by their rules. More and more, white people are going to try to fight by system rules, and they're going to lose. They got to learn to fight dirty, sneaky, and so on and so on. One thing I forgot was that out of the N-word game yesterday, at the end of the game, they're interviewing this one big black fellow. His name was Malcolm Smith, and while he was started to talk about the game, a white guy ran up and grabbed his microphone and to tell about what a criminal thing 9/11 was, a 9/11 truther.
Investigate 9/11. 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government. 9/11. 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government.
All right.
Investigate 9/11. 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government.
All right.
Investigate 9/11. 9/11 was perpetrated by people within our own government.
And as usual, when this brief encounter is over, the big black fellow, this African-American, sits there with this dull, dumb, typically anthropoid look on his face, not realizing really what happened or understanding anything. It was funny as hell. You can pick it up. I think it's probably gone viral by now on the internet.
Gather round, Captain, I'll tell you a story about how to become an all-American boy. Buy you a guitar, put it in tune. You be rocking and rolling soon. Impressing the girls, picking hot licks. Be good. Hot legs. Showing off. Number one. Did I practice all day and then up into the night? My papa's hair was turning white because he didn't like rock and roll. He said, "You can stay, boy, but that's got to go." He's a square. He just didn't dig me at all. Guitar, picks and all, bid farewell tomorrow. Memphis, where they see all them swinging cats are having a ball session. Hot licks and all. They dig it. I'm rocking and a bopping and I'm getting the breaks. The girls all said that I had what it takes. When up stepped a man with a big cigar, he said, "Come here, cat, I'm gonna make you a star. I put you on bandstand, buy you a Cadillac, sign here, kid." I signed my name and became a star, having a ball with my guitar, driving a big long Cadillac, fighting the girls off in the back. They just kept on coming, screaming. Yeah, they like it. So I picked my guitar with a great big grin, and the money just kept on pouring in. But then one day my Uncle Sam, he says, "Here I am. Uncle Sam needs you, boy. I'm going to cut your hair off. Take that rifle, kid. Give me that guitar."